So rolling solo today on Ye Olde Podcast. Merrick is out and about doing his thing, and I will begin the show with a mea culpa. I don't like, as you know, to admit when I do things incorrectly. Although I am a humble person, none of us really likes to screw up epically, right? And I screwed up epically yesterday, and I screwed up epically in a meeting with Bobby Orr for the first time, which, of course, for a hockey fan is, you know, meeting Moses. It ain't Jesus. I mean, Jesus would be like Gretzky or Mario probably, right? But Bobby Orr is in the pantheon, and it was a pleasure to meet him. I had a few moments to interview him, and I was very excited about this. So anyway, I'm at the NHL store where he's doing this signing of his new book, and there's a ton of fans waiting there. And so Bobby Orr is on NHL Live. So he's on NHL Live. He's doing an interview, talking to the boys, Mears and EJ. And I'm on a catwalk between their studio and a staircase that brings us down to where all of the fans are waiting to get a glimpse of Bobby Orr, get their book signed. So I'm supposed to talk to him at like 20 to 5. And they're going long. And now it's 45. And 48. And 50. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I have all of these questions I want to ask Bobby Orr, and I am starting to get a little nervous that I'm only going to get a few in. And if you've been a reporter, you know you'd like to kind of establish a rhythm. You don't want to go in and start immediately on fighting or start immediately on contracts or all of this stuff that we talked about eventually, but you didn't really want to go in with the high, hard heat first, right? You want to kind of ease it in. So I'm thinking to myself, what's a good, quick icebreaker for Bobby Orr? And thinking to myself, well, a good quick icebreaker for Bobby Orr is probably to talk about how famous he is being Bobby Orr. He's Bobby Orr. What does that mean when he goes and visits Boston? What does that mean if he goes anywhere in Canada? What does it mean to be Bobby Orr? And I'm thinking to myself, it probably means what it means for any famous athlete in any city in the world, which is that you show up at the bar and people just start throwing drinks at you. Just buying them left and right. Bobby Orr is so famous, I'm thinking to myself, that he probably has not had to buy his own drinks in, I would say, the last, 40 years? Maybe more? So I'm thinking, all right, that's a way to ease in. Hey, isn't it crazy how famous you are, Bobby Orr? Now it's 50. Now it's 51. Now it's 52. And I'm thinking to myself, I have got no time with this guy. And I'm getting a little nervous, right? Because I really want to get something for the blog and you know, talk about the book, talk about his thoughts on especially the fighting thing, which, you know, was a big point of concern for a lot of people because, like, he was one of the few guys to come out in favor of it at a time when a lot of people didn't really, all the old guys were saying, get rid of it. So finally the door opens and the NHL Live staffers start flooding out, and I look inside and Bobby Orr is, you know, signing a book for Steve Mears or something. And now it's like 53, now it's like 54. And so finally Bobby Orr emerges. Good looking dude, right? Legendary guy. Has the gravitas, as they say. Come over, shake his hand. Some of the NHL PR folks do the intro. And I'm talking to Bobby Orr. And, you know, it's cool, right? It's an amazing moment. So he's like, hey, do you want to do this here? I'm like, nah, sure, we can do it here, wherever you want to do it. He's like, let's just step over into this hallway here. So now we're in a hallway. And down at the other end of the hallway is the staircase leading to where all the fans are waiting to get Bobby Orr's autograph. So just trying to give you a sense of the geography here. So I begin, I flip on the recorder, and I begin speaking to Robert Orr, NHL legend, hockey god. And I say, so when's the last time you had to buy a drink for yourself in either Boston or Canada, being that you're a famous guy? And his entire demeanor changes. And I'm like, oh, shit. And he goes, was this some kind of a joke interview? I'm like, ah, mama. He's like, I'm not doing any joke interviews. You want to talk about hockey? You want to talk about the book? That's fine. But I'm not doing any joke interviews. And Bobby Orr turns and begins to walk away. And I'm thinking to myself, I have made a grave mistake in this interview. So I kind of grab his arm, hoping that he's not going to do the get the F off me arm move, or he whips his arm and takes my hand off him and then wheels around and like punches me or something. And I'm like, hey, you know, I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to offend anybody. You know, wasn't trying to be, it's not a joke. I want to talk about the book. I want to talk about hockey. And he's now got like 2 feet down the staircase going to where the fans are. And I'm thinking I've just screwed up an interview with Bobby Orr. And, none of the PR people that are in the area are cognizant of this at the moment. And I'm trying to smooth things over. I'm saying I just want to talk about hockey. And then finally he takes one more step down the staircase and he stops. And he turns around and he looks at me and he kind of just says, just hockey. I'm like, fine. So he comes back upstairs and then we begin to have a very pleasant conversation about hockey. You'll read on Puck Daddy, I think today or tomorrow, fighting, contracts, player desire, what it's like to see fans wearing the Bobby Orr jersey. Come to find out later, he doesn't drink, obviously, is the postscript to this for whatever reason. But yeah, so nearly committed some level of career suicide by chasing away Bobby Orr in the first 2 seconds of an interview and making Bobby Orr think that I'm like Stuttering John or some guy trying to play a gag on him instead of talk to hockey with him. It is as embarrassing moments go as a journalist, probably top 2-3. I can't think of some of the other ones. I mean, some of the other ones I once knocked. Okay. It might be number 2 behind the time that I knocked down a high school basketball team's second place trophy in a locker room. I actually kicked it over going to talk to somebody and broke it. That's probably number 1 still. The looks on the faces of the dejected state runners up. Seeing the lumbering fat reporter crush their second place trophy as if he were a man in a Godzilla suit crushing tanks in a miniature Tokyo. That's probably still number 1, but the insulting Bobby Orr to the point where Bobby Orr nearly turned his back and walked away from the interview, I'm gonna guess is number two.
He could have pulled this on you though, Wish, from Bryce Harper.
What kind of statement is
this?
Sorry.
It's illegal to drink in the States at 19. Why don't you ask
something
else?
Not in Canada.
I'm not
answering
that.
That's a clown question, bro.
Well, then it becomes a different story if he says bro, right? I mean, at least then I'd have that going for me. But like I was there writing in the Starbucks in the NHL store for a while, and like I was thinking about trying to go over and like apologize because like seriously didn't mean to offend the guy, and clearly it's a sensitive subject, right? So I just felt like dog shit. I just felt like complete dog shit, Matt. Just terrible.
Yeah, that like just the fact it's Bobby Orr makes it that
I know.
Tough. That's the tough, like I've made some mistakes. I remember interviewing Colin Stewart when he was with the Rochester Americans.
Uh-huh.
And I thought he was his brother Mark for some stupid reason in my head. I'm like, so when did you start playing forward? And he's like, my whole career. And I'm like, No, I used to play D. He's like, no, you're thinking of my brother. Yeah. So he was offended, but it wasn't Bobby Orr.
I've seen bad questions like that. I saw somebody ask a Capitals player that had been there for 3 years what it felt like to join the team at the trade deadline and then make the playoffs. That was squirmy.
Yeah,
and that actually earned give me an effing break from one of the Caps beat writers like in the back
good.
Of the scrum, but. Yeah, embarrassing journalism moments 101. That is a course in what not to say. And in hindsight, thinking about it again, like it's not a bad icebreaker as far as like a first line goes, but it's I maybe should just modulate booze to drinking. I mean to dinner rather. Like don't approach it by saying, "Oh, hey, I drink and it would be wonderful to be famous and have people throw drinks in my direction wherever I go." I'll just ask him about that because I'm projecting. No, I think dinner might be the more appropriate question going forward because not all of us are of the same mindset or history when it comes to beverage. So that's it. So Bobby Orr interview coming up on Puck Daddy today, I believe. It really was a pleasure meeting him, and it wound up being an enlightening and awesome conversation, albeit a brief one. That is why Joe Pack I did not ask him about the Kit Kat story. That is why all the people who mentioned this yesterday to me, I did not also ask him what it's like to be arguably the best defenseman of all time. I somehow felt after insulting the man to the point where he nearly turned and walked away 2 seconds into the interview, that asking him if he felt he was arguably the best defenseman of all time might not be tactful, might not be the right tact to take. So on that score, I did not ask. But again, it's Bobby Orr. It was great to meet him. And again, the humble dude. I was talking to somebody afterwards about Bobby Orr and wondering whether or not Bobby knows what he is and what he means to the people. And I get the sense that he does, but at the same time, he's a guy that turns to you during an appearance in which, you know, hundreds of people have planned their days around coming down to Manhattan and meeting this guy. He's the guy that turns to you and says, I didn't think there'd be this many people here because I thought they were all Ranger fans and they didn't like me. I mean, it's that he's that kind of guy. So anyways, there's the Bobby Orr embarrassment story. I feel the need to hoist myself on the cross and confess to all of you my journalistic sin. And, you know, I put up a good front on this show. A lot of it's attitude. You know, it's the way it is. I mean, Merrick's the good Canadian boy, and I've got to be a little bit brash than I am. I felt epically terrible yesterday. Epically terrible. I mean, I make mistakes now and again and do my best to correct them and what have you. But, like, that's one you just wish you could hop in the DeLorean and go back in time and redo it because you insulted somebody who genuinely is a great guy and was taking moments out of an extraordinarily busy day to talk to you. So, lesson learned, don't joke about booze. With that, we start the show proper.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
They are selling hope. And you need hope on
They're
display.
Selling
hope
exactly.
on display. That's right. When he drinks, you've been around him when he drinks, and he drinks often. He has a problem, folks.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Yesterday was make your own deli sandwich day. I made a delicious chicken salad on Asiago cheese roll with a truffle mayonnaise. I've only done one radio interview on the toilet.
Debate hockey.
I'm happy that neither of us are Russian today.
Well, we were Russian yesterday because we didn't do the show. We were scratched. Healthy scratched.
Hey, look here. Here we go. This
is
texting Merrick during the game.
Pop culture.
Leave those special brownies at home. Jeff and I have had enough, I tell you.
Yeah, indeed. I don't care. You can...
No.
I don't care about those cookies. You keep those to yourself. Nope, won't see me eating those. No siree.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
No siree. No. No special cookies. Coming up on the show, the general manager of the mighty, mighty Phoenix Coyotes off to a franchise best start, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. I mean, they're on a hell of a roll right now. He, of course, is Don Maloney. He'll be joining us on the show. Also later in the show, a man whose name is Harrison Mooney will be joining us on the program to talk about being Harrison Mooney and all things NHL as well. So that's exciting. Also, it's going postal day, which means that anything you want to ask me without Merrick here, including stuff about Merrick, you could do so. PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com, at Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick on Twitter, hashtag it MVSW. Sean Monahan is being kept up by the Calgary Flames. No sending back Sean Monahan to junior. Says Jay Feaster, he's a 19-year-old going on 29 years old. We're a big believer in him and all this jive. The Flames are going to make a decision on Monahan's potential participation in the 2014 World Junior Championship closer to the start of the tournament as well. It's a lose-lose for them in some ways. You want to believe that they are going to regress, that they're not going to be a playoff team, and that all of the points he's putting up now, I mean, aren't going to mean anything, unless you believe that they're going to mean something for his development as a player going forward, which is quite possible. It's quite possible that if you believe in the notion that Monahan has accomplished everything he can down a level or two, and that being in the pros is going to make him a better pro, then maybe it's worth burning the year on the contract. I don't know. But at the same time, I don't think that the Flames would have taken a ton of criticism from outside of Calgary if they had sent him back, right? But maybe it becomes an impossible thing to do when he's played as well as he has. And it's quite possible. It's quite possible that Monahan had played himself into the pros, and it made it impossible from a PR perspective, from a competitive perspective. I mean, obviously, he's playing a key role in the team. It made it impossible for them to send him back. So kudos to him for pushing the issue and not making it an easy situation. Also wanted to mention the Lars Eller motivational speaker thing that happened, where Eller obviously motivated the Edmonton Oilers. And let's take a listen to Dallas Eakins last night thanking Lars Eller for it.
It's games like that that you don't even really need to go play them. When you have a player like Lars Eller running his mouth before the game, it makes for a great banter in our dressing room and a great motivation. So we thank Lars Eller for his comments before the game. Awesome.
The awesome part. Didn't Dallas sound exactly like Agent Smith, by the way, during that?
Mr. Anderson, thanks for motivating the rest of the agents.
Didn't he sound like that a little bit? It's kind of what I got, the vibe I got off of it.
He did. It was pretty good. It was Dallas Eakins. I covered Dallas Eakins for the last 3 years in Toronto, and he is an awesome quote. He says some great things, so that did not surprise me in any way. And
he's a guy who seems to, out of one side of his mouth, bemoan the media, but on the other side of his mouth, completely crave it. Am I accurate in saying that?
Oh, 100%. A lot like Brian Burke in the fact that, you know, criticizes the media, but uses them so much.
You guys in the media, come over here and listen to my press conference.
Sean Avery in Calgary. Hey, guys, yeah. I got something to say.
Also, Eakins, I believe, we also have the clip of the great present, was it?
Yes.
Loved it. Yeah. It's like, they might as well sent me over a fruit basket and a bottle of wine. I was like, man, that is just perfect. Yeah, that was a really great present that Mr. Eller laid on us today.
A fruit basket and a bottle of wine.
It's pretty amazing, right? But honestly, it's like it really is such a baffling thing. I mean, again, he's a younger player. He obviously didn't realize it was going to become a bulletin board material. But you always have to realize it's going to become bulletin board material. That's the bottom line. That's the thing. Sort of an embarrassing moment. But great audio. And again, just goes to show you that you never know what's going to wind up giving lifeblood to a team, right? It's it was pretty amazing to see the level of motivation that the Edmonton Oilers were able to glean from that last night. One other thing, as we gear up for Mr. Maloney to join us, Marty Brodeur with some very interesting comments before the podcast today about passing the torch to Corey Schneider. Now, the thing about Marty always is that there's a level, I don't want to call it self-deprecation necessarily, but there's a level of sort of humility sometimes in his words. He's not exactly the boastful guy. It's always been, in my opinion, the difference between Marty and Patrick Waugh is that they're both the two of the best goaltenders of all time, but Patrick Waugh will tell you about it, while Marty will just kind of let things stand where they are. Brodeur says via Rich Scher of the Star-Ledger on Corey Schneider as the Devil starter, "I think he's in the net now to stay. I don't think that's going to change. I'll be ready if it does. I hate not playing. That's the bottom line. I'm glad this happens at 41 and not 27. So it's kind of interesting that the notion from Brodeur right now is that the torch has been passed. I tend to believe he'll get another shot at taking back that crease like Luongo did. But who had October 23rd in the pool as far as Schneider usurping Brodeur in Brodeur's own words? Anyway, joining us now on the line, a man who should be quite happy about the way of the world these days. His team, 6-2-2 start, 14 points in the Pacific Division, and he is a favorite of this very podcast. He is Don Maloney joining us here on the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast. Hello, Mr. Maloney. How are you?
I'm just fine, thanks.
That's good to hear. I'm rolling solo today. No Jeff Merrick. It's just me, Greg. But pleasure to have you aboard. Let's start with someone that you signed last summer who is making you look real smart. 9 points in 10 games for Mike Ribeiro, and all of it coming in the last 7 games in which you guys haven't lost in regulation. Talk to us about what Mike Ribeiro brings to the Coyotes.
Well, you know, Greg, we last summer, I mean, well, it's been really the last 4 or 5 years, we've been trying to find a creative center iceman. And really, when Mike's case, even though he was an unrestricted free agent, we had such good insight into him because Dave Tippett knew him, coached him. Their wives are friendly. They remain friendly. So we really felt he was a good fit for us. And it wasn't as though you're – a lot of times when you go into the free agent market, you're hoping and praying you have a good idea what the player is like, but you don't really understand the person, the personality. And even though Mike Ribeiro is a little quirky in some ways, we felt we had a real good feel on what he could bring us. And then fortunately for us, he's been doing exactly as advertised. He's come in and made some plays. I thought in the first 4 or 5 games, he started slow, you know, kind of getting to know everybody and know our style out here. But certainly in the last 3 or 4 games, he's been creative and making the plays when we need them. They made scoring some big goals at key times and or setting up a play at key times. So all in all, it's worked out well so far.
Yeah, earning that top line money is what he's doing. That's pretty impressive. I mean, it's been a great run for you guys, without question. Obviously, is there a clause in Mike Smith's contract where he gets more money if he scores goals? Is my question.
That's a good point. It was one of the few things we didn't give him when we signed him. But you know what, Greg? What's interesting, I know when you look at a record and say, wow, these guys are off to a pretty good start. But when you really break it down, you know, 5 of our 6 wins have been against Eastern Conference teams. And a couple of those teams have been struggling to start, the Rangers and Philly. And you know they'll be better. So, you know, when we look at our team right now, we say, wow, it's good. It beats the alternative. We think we're off to a good start. And what we learned last year, we got off to a very poor start. And by the time we got our game in gear, we could never catch up. So we also looked and say, you know what, it looks like for us to get out of the Western Division, we're going to have to go through California. And then those California teams, starting with San Jose and certainly Anaheim and L.A., are really, that's a tall task. So we're really have a lot of work ahead of us. Nobody's popping any champagne out here in the desert quite yet. We've got a lot of work to do.
Oliver Ekman-Larsson, 22, I believe, fourth year in the league now. We were talking before you hopped on, Henrik Zetterberg putting him over the other day as really developing as a player. Tell us what you've seen in his game as far as development year to year.
Well, you know what? Anybody that's followed us, I know it's a little tougher in the East because the games come on pretty late, but he's you might argue Mike Smith is our most important player, but certainly Oliver, the where his game is going, he would be 1A. Just the minutes he plays and the matchups, and you know, he's an intelligent mobile puck mover. He's got to play on both sides of the puck every night. He and Zdeněk Mihalik match up against the best players in the other team, and last night, I think he played over 29 minutes. So it gives you a sense of his value to us. He's just a young, developing star player. It's the best way to put it. We could use a few more of them out here, but he's been great for us. And then really is a, you know, as Shane Doan continues to emerge or age and leaves us at some point, hopefully not for a long, long time. We certainly look at Oliver saying he's going to be the next guy to lead this team for the next 10 years or so.
I think the East Coast bias thing helps, by the way, because I know my peers, and I'm based out of Washington, D.C. I'm in New York today. I know my peers, and I feel like Oliver Ekman-Larsson's name is automatic for many of us when it comes to a Norris ballot or a best defenseman list. It may not necessarily even be that, you know, we've all seen the games he's played. It's just that the level of renown and his name being mentioned so often just makes him someone that becomes automatic for us.
Well, you know what's interesting, Greg? It's probably comes from the other teams in the West that get on the station. You know, we all talk about other teams on point, and everybody knows how good this player, young player, is. He is really a dynamic in his own way. Eats up a lot of minutes. He's just that good. He's one of the best. And I know LA have Doughty, and Anaheim have some very good players, and certainly Danny Boyle and Vlasic and players like this in San Jose are West here. But in Oliver's case, and I think he's still maturing. I mean, he's still you know, he's still just filling out as a man. He's got a young, even though he's now 22 now, 23, he's just starting to fill into his body. And so I think the upside, God willing, as I touch wood, my head, he stays healthy, but he has tremendous upside. Last year, we signed a very lucrative deal And at the time, quite frankly, there was some Norris Trophy rumblings, and Ren rightly so. When we end up putting up the numbers he starts putting up and eating up the minutes he eats up and playing against the best on the other line, other teams you play, generally you're going to get some league-wide notice at Eastern.
Speaking of players that maybe folks back east have not seen that much of, what's gotten into Rob Klinkhammer this year, 8 points in 10 games?
He's been a real find, and really have to credit our pro scouting staff, Frank Effinger and Derek McKinnon and David McClain. Like, you know, that's what you pay your scouts to do, is get into the American Hockey League and find somebody that can play in your team that you don't have to spend millions and millions and millions on. In Rob's case, I think he was it's an interesting dynamic, Greg, because, you know, every of the first-round picks, and they come in at 18 and 19 and 20, and they're not in the league at 21. Everybody thinks they're a bust, and they think they're a bust, and generally they're off to Europe at 23, 20. Now, in Rob's case, here's a guy that he came in and played in the American League a long time, bounced around a couple organizations, found his niche with us last year in Portland, and we just thought, watching him last year in Portland, we said, you know, we have got to give this guy a legitimate chance to play. He's big, he can skate, he shoots the puck. He plays a hard game, not a fighting tough game, but he plays a hard game. He fits into our third and fourth line profile. So he's come up and been as advertised and better. And he just has all the ingredients of being a good, versatile role player. He can kill penalties. He drives the net. And right now, certainly his offensive contribution is key for us. We need contribution from everybody, and Rob has certainly gone over and above his expectation, at least to this point in the season.
Speaking of offensive contribution, I think I saw that you folks and Radim Verbata have decided to put off contract talks till after the season. Is that a mutual decision, or was that his camp saying, let's just go through this season, grab some big stats, and then renegotiate then?
Yeah, we had several discussions prior to the start of the season, and at the end of the day, Greg, it's always the same thing. It's about turning dollars, and so it was really Radom's decision to say, you know what, I'd rather not be distracted during the year. I'd like to see if we can get something done. If not, let's just table to end the year. He's been a good player for us, an important player, and we certainly feel like he can have another great season, and then we can attempt to get something done at the end of the year. I have no problem waiting as far as I'm concerned. I my philosophy is always this. I like to pay on performance, but I don't like to pay on potential. And
right.
So I think in Radom's case, he's been – you know, you think of the West here, he's probably been a little bit under the radar in the sense of his actual production versus the name recognition, but we recognize his value. And yet, you know, we have to be responsible for what we do contractually, so he's important to us.
Do you think the fact that he's a guy who may already realize the grass isn't always greener will play into his negotiations with you?
Well, I surely hope so. He's been, I think Radom's mature. Another player, as he's gotten older, he's sort of matured, and I think he recognized, I'm a good player in this league, and he is a good player. So I think he did venture out at one point a few years ago. He signed a very lucrative contract somewhere else. Didn't quite pan out for him. We got him back, and Greg, some players just come into organizations and they fit. And I think in Radom, he fits with us. However, like everybody else, they'd like to get paid, and that's where that's where we have to work out at something. And I'm relatively confident in this crazy world that we're looking at with contracts that we'll be able to get something done at some point.
Hey, so let me ask you about life with new owners. I think a lot of us are curious to see how your day-to-day or even your approach to things has changed now that there are actual owners that aren't Gary Bettman. How is life for you with the new bosses?
Well, it's terrific, actually. George Gosby is the chairman of the board, and he's who I report to, and they've been nothing but supportive, especially the hockey side. They've really taken Anthony LeBlanc is overseeing the business side. They've really invested the time and energy, and most of their focus has been on the business operation, whereas they've left us on the hockey side to continue to do our thing. But you know, Greg, what's real good is to have it's little things. You know, the last 4 years we'd have a pre-season dinner with the wives and the and the players, and just and when we go to we get a six pack six packs and the Happy Meals from McDonald's, you know. But now the owners came in, they took us out to a nice restaurant, very well done. We really need an upgrade in our exercise room at the jobbing.com, and just some bikes and some equipment, and we're able to go to them and right away. They, you know, so it's those little things that you don't think of that. But they're very, very important in sort of the culture you're trying to create here. So it's been terrific. George has been on several of our early trips here. He sits, we sit up together during the games. He's a very quiet, astute person. He watches the game. He understands that it takes time and resources to build a champion. So as far as I'm concerned, it's having the NHL, Bill Daly, and certainly Gary Bettman, in a lot of ways, overseeing your club, in some ways, it would never be better. Because quite frankly, they give you a budget. They say, here's your budget. Don't ever call us if you need a nickel more, but do a good job. But you can never, in my opinion, Greg, you can never build long-term this way, because you're always just in a survival mode. Now we can look out 2, 3, 5 years down the road. What do we need to do here in Arizona in the valley to build a champion culture, like right. You look at San Jose, and certainly LA have been there a long time. We aren't Toronto. We aren't New York. We're not a traditional franchise. But we have to create an environment that demands success, and that's the focus of this new group. They're here. They're here for long term, and they want to build a winner.
I know a lot of us had sympathy for you during this ordeal, but I don't think we realize that the players' wives were forced to survive on Big Macs and Chicken McNuggets. I mean, this is beyond the pale, sir, and I can't believe that the whole thing lasted as long as it did. A couple of questions for you before we let you go about league issues. You're obviously someone who's very involved in, like, competition committee stuff and that sort of thing. Your thoughts in the first month of the season on hybrid icing from what you've seen?
I'm a little mixed. I was not supportive of it when it came up I was not convinced. And we all want everybody and the plays are involved in the game that's front and center. But I just think the ramifications, the judgment of the officials, I think it's still being worked out, and I'm still mixed on it, quite frankly. It's a very, very fast, high-paced game to have the linesmen have to make these judgment calls. And I think we're all just sort of getting used to it, because in every game there seems to be two or three instances where you might think, well, that in the normal old way of doing things, there would be a different call there. So I'm on the fence right now.
Interesting. And then the other issue that I was really on the soapbox about and championing before the season that I didn't see come through was the video review for high sticking incidences. Where were you on that, and why didn't it work out?
Well, I thought it was a good thing. It's the judgment call. So much when you get into these meetings, Greg, you know, you're trying to say, okay, I think we have a great product. It's fast. It's entertaining. When you start introducing further reviews and circumstances of you, and the NHL doesn't do anything off the cuff. They spend a lot of time,
right.
Colin Campbell and Mike Murphy, that's their jobs and their lives, trying to figure out what can work, and if there is a decision, how that's going to affect the game. And so I think in that case, really review is just part of it was what gets reviewed, what's the time frame in regards to how long is it going to take to look at something. And then all of a sudden, if now you're adding 2, 3, 5 minutes to every game, is that the right thing to do? So it's ongoing. We have a meeting, Greg, next month in Toronto, the general managers, and many of these issues are going to be back on the agenda, and they continue to be on the agenda because the game is in great shape. I think it's exciting to watch, but it's always being tweaked. And the video review, hybrid icing, the fighting, issue, and those things are all being discussed on a regular basis 3-4 times a year when we all get together trying to figure out what's the right thing to do from a entertainment, from a safety, and a product point of view.
Good stuff. Hey, Don Maloney, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Always a pleasure to speak with you, and continued success for the resurgent Coyotes. Glad everything got – I'm so happy we don't have to talk to you about the Glendale City Council anymore, because those meetings were atrocious.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, Greg. Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
Don Maloney, ladies and gentlemen. Harrison Mooney coming up soon. But, yeah, Maloney's like Ken Holland and a few of other GMs that I love to talk to about league issues because they're thoughtful about it. There's some guys that you talk to on a GM level that the management of their own team is so paramount that they just kind of give some cursory words here and there about those types of issues, hybridizing, things of that nature. But Maloney's one of these guys that takes a real active approach to the league issues, rules changes, that kind of thing. So he's always a good talk to you. I get a sense in talking to guys like Maloney and some other people around the league, on the record, off the record, I'm wondering if we're going to see hybrid icing beyond this season, to be honest with you. There's a lot of fence sitting. There's a lot of people that are kind of saying the same thing in a position of power level, which is that I had a notion of what this was going to look like on paper, but now I have some doubts about it in practice, you know? And it's odd because, like, it was workshopped in the AHL, and they should all have a sense of what this thing is by now, but I think on the NHL level, if there isn't some major tweak happening in which maybe the finish line, for lack of a better term, is more established than simply the dot, and it becomes less theoretical, if maybe there is some kind of movement on what to do when you have two guys approaching from different directions, that whole thing, I feel like we might see a dialing back, and I don't know what happens then. Because I can't – it's hard for me to imagine this league, knowing how they approach player safety, to have them dial it back to traditional icing again, because obviously the reason we have hybrid icing is because it's a safety issue. So why would you turn the wheels back and then go to something that's deemed not safe? But I can't also imagine them going to no touch because there's not an appetite for it. So I wouldn't be surprised to see hybrid icing – spiked for at least a little bit to kind of work out the kinks after the season. But at the same time, you know, when you think of the alternatives, either going back to something that you've deemed not safe or going to no touch where there's no appetite for that on a league level, it's going to be really interesting to see what they end up doing. So, but he's, you know, Maloney's kind of doing the same thing we've heard from a few guests on the show during the last month, which is that they are sort of on the fence when it comes to hybridizing. My next guest has a bleeding heart, so I imagine he loves hybridizing because it keeps everyone safe in this downy soft league of ours. He's our old friend Harrison Mooney from Puck Daddy.
Bleeding heart.
That's... You are, though, aren't you?
Oh, a little bit. You know, I love safety. And if loving safety makes you a bleeding heart, then let my heart bleed.
You must be really a big fan of the you have to leave your helmet on to fight rule, yeah?
No, I think it's stupid. But I mean, that's because I think fighting is stupid. Like I think at this point, I don't really understand the rule, you know. And they keep trying to like tweak it a little bit. Like, well, yeah, you know, now if the helmets come off, oh, the linesman's going to jump in and stop. Look, okay, if we're really that concerned about the safety of these dudes' heads, maybe don't let another dude punch it a bunch of times. Like, I just feel like that's a really good way for a head to get hurt.
I do in a story about the Department of Player Safety that'll be on Puck Daddy tomorrow. And the fighting thing seems to be such a huge nuisance for them because it makes their job so difficult to, on the one hand, be like, you know, any contact, any injurious contact with the head – should be suspension worthy, and we need to get this out of the game. Oh, by the way, our league also quasi-endorses fists, pounding flesh, and skulls. I think it makes their job impossible. There's a logical gap between trying to protect the players and not having draconian rules banning fighting. And the looks on some of these guys' faces when you bring it up, it's like they don't know what to say anymore.
No, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And I mean, you know, I get it. I get that, you know, if you get hit wrong and you fall and you hit your head on the ice, you know, the league is going to look pretty silly if they were like, yeah, go ahead, take your helmet off before you fight on this slippery hard surface. But at the same time, it just makes them look so foolish when, you know, you're going to say, okay, you guys can take your gloves off. You can pound on each other with, you know, your hard bone hands. And then what we don't want, though, is after all the face punching, after this bare knuckle boxing break, we don't want someone to get hurt
falling down. Like that. I think it makes them look hypocritical. It makes them look silly. I think at this point, if there's really that much concern that someone can get hurt during a fight, maybe don't have fighting.
Yeah. You know, it's the fighting thing. I'm not going to make this about fighting because we talked about fighting ad infinitum on this show. But, like, I just want to make it clear on the Yzerman thing again because I'm still taking shit for it. Like, my problem is not that he changed his mind on fighting, even if he maybe did care about it in the past and doesn't care about it now and thinks it should be gone. I'm not saying that you're not allowed to. I'm just saying own up to the way that you used to think. And I think in the case of him and my good friend Larry Brooks, who greeted me so warmly the other day in D.C., and others, there needs to be some acknowledgement. Maybe just a mea culpa, I was wrong or something. Or, you know, there was a time when fighting was beneficial from a player safety perspective, but not now. That's all I'm looking for, you know?
Well, so you're asking for these guys to really, like, give you the narrative of how they came to this conclusion now? I mean, that...
Yeah.
I don't know if Yzerman is really the sort of... I mean... That seems more like a writerly thing to do. Like, maybe you can give it to Larry Brooks for that. You know, hey, you should be, you know, at least tell us, acknowledge that you used to be here and now you're over here. But, I mean, you know, Steve Yzerman he's not writing a book on fighting. Like, I don't know if he really needs to do that.
I guess maybe they don't want to go down that rabbit hole because complete speculation here. You figure the death of Probert affected Yzerman in a pretty severe way. You figure the death of Bugard probably affected any Rangers writer in a pretty severe way, having covered him and having seen how that whole thing went down. So maybe they just don't want to go down that road and talk about the severity of those situations being the reason why all of a sudden there's aspects of being hypocritical in their thinking on fighting. I don't know. But you're right. I am sort of looking for, because maybe it helps me in the end, Harrison. Maybe it helps me modulate my thoughts on fighting to hear how a guy that I look up to in Yzerman came around to believe what he believes.
Well,
now, granted, for me, I mean, obviously at the end of the day, I'm still going to be cheering the Lions as they devour the Catholics, or the Christians rather, because I'm someone who will freely admit without any second thought that fighting is entertaining to me.
Well, yeah, and I mean, Lions greater than Christians, right?
This is true.
If I had to have a best friend, like I'm going with, if my options for a best friend are like Tony the Tiger or like, you know, my old youth pastor, I'm going with Tony.
Depends. Depends. Does your old youth pastor have a spear and a net? If so?
No.
Then there's no fighting chance.
He's armed with a Bible, he has a moleskin notebook, and he wants to rap. You know?
Hey, so let me ask you a Vancouver question, because as many of you may or may not know, probably do know, Harrison, along with writing for Puck Daddy, is one of the proprietors of Pass It to Bulis, the best blog ever named for Jan Bulis, at least for the moment. What has been your opinion, sir, of John Tortorella as Vancouver coach?
I think it's been good so far. Like it's funny because, you know, everybody out here wants to react like everything he does is somehow so different than Alain Vigneault did it. Like my favorite thing was, you know, Tortorella split up the Sedins, and there were people like, well, it's finally good to see a coach who's willing to make the tough decisions. Yeah, like Alain Vigneault had never split up the Sedins before. Like, of course he had. A lot of these things, you know, and there was a time, too, people were really pissy about, you know, Vigneault mixing up his lines. You know, he changes lines from period to period, game to game, and people would be like, oh, just let these guys play and get some chemistry with one another. And then Tortorella started doing it, and people were like, oh, wow, man, you know, it's finally great to see a coach who's not afraid to mix up his lines when things aren't going well. And so... You know, I think that there's been a lot of frustration on my end, just, you know, watching what Tortorella is doing differently, and it's not really that pronounced. I mean, I don't think it's a massive difference between what he did and what Vigneault did, but, you know, after 7-8 years of Alain Vigneault, everything just looks like an amazing, wonderful new innovation from a coach who's just blowing our minds.
I never had a problem with anybody splitting up the Sedins, only because of the way Bylsma handles Crosby and Malkin. Like, if needs be, the mega powers will unite, and then you're in big trouble. But aren't they kind of – I mean, maybe the Sedins are such a unique animal that they have to play together to get the maximum out of them, and it's besides the point to split them up. It's not as if you're taking two fantastic players and putting them on different lines as a unit combined, they are what works. I mean, are they, or can you split them up?
I think you can split them up. What I've liked about what Tortorella has done with them is he's just using them like crazy. This is the first season in their entire NHL careers where they're going to average over 20 minutes a game, which is insane to me. I mean, you've got – these guys are hockey freaks. You know, I think, you know, we're going to – once they're gone, we're going to be able to tell our kids, like, there was a time there were these Swedish identical twins – and they played on the same line. And, you know, people are going to think we made this up because it's ridiculous. But, yeah, you know, Tortorella, he came in here and he just decided he was going to use them like crazy. And what we've seen is in games where they're not scoring, it's not happening. By the third period, he's got them playing on different lines, and then he's playing those two lines almost exclusively. And it's not so much about him splitting up the Sedins to punish them or because they're not going. It's just that he wants more Sedin more often. He's just trying to squeeze more Sedin out of his lineup. I feel like those third period adjustments, like that's him like scraping the side of the blender after you've made a fruit smoothie. Like, I got to get all of this fruit smoothie, the Sedin smoothie. I got to have it all.
Yum.
Delicious.
Yum, Sedin smoothie. Lick up that Sedin smoothie. Yes, indeed.
I can't.
A Sedin smoothie, by the way, to me would taste of smoked fish and lingonberry. Is what I'm guessing.
That's disgusting.
Isn't it, though? Let's talk about your friend Luongo.
You mean James Duffy?
I was going to ask you that question. when is it okay for us to all start talking about how completely uncomfortable this James Duffy, Roberto Luongo, attached at the hip relationship is? I mean, I tried to, and I got yelled at for it from one of the principals, but... I mean, honestly, dude, like, he tweeted a picture that Duffy took.
Yeah, no, it's super weird. I have a theory, actually, that what happens is every season in October, Luongo decides he wants to take another month off, and so he and James Duffy actually just switch. So that's why October Luongo is so bad, is because he's actually James Duffy.
Wow. What an interesting thought that is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. But
I can't get behind that thought, but it's a good thought.
No, it's weird. Like, as far as their relationship goes, though, it's bordering on weird. I mean, obviously, it's cool that they're super friends, and, you know, I'm glad for them. I'm sure that, you know, when they get together and they put their, like, half of a heart necklaces together to make one whole heart, that makes them feel really great. But at the same time, it's a little weird. It's a little odd. I just kind of feel like there should maybe be a little more distance between the athlete and the guy that's supposed to be covering him.
Do you think that Roberto wears the part of the heart that says Lou and that Duffy has the Ongo?
No. My thinking actually is that the heart just says Lou. And so Roberto's part says Lou and Duffy's Lou. Part says ooh.
So, right. So it looks like love you. You, mm-hmm. if you take the iconography, that's very interesting. finally, Harrison Mooney, wanted to ask you about hockey hugs, because hockey hugs are the thing that people love so bad on Puck Daddy, and you do them. And so my question to you is, when you are perusing the sports image galleries, trying to find the quintessential hockey hug, what are some of the attributes that you look for?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, you're just looking for a beautiful tableau, right? What you want is a shot where you can see, you know, really everything. Like, you can see the players wrapped around one another. If you can see joyful faces, you know, that's key. Facial expression is important. I mean, I'll find a lot of hugs where, you know, the photographer, he's got the hug, but you're not seeing any faces. And it's like, well, I mean, I want to know how these players are reacting to being this close. I imagine... they're reacting with, you know, swelling hearts because I am here from home, but I want to see it on their faces. And so, there's a lot of that. And then, you know, just the little things that I prefer. A big guy hugging a little guy, that's gold, comedy gold.
Your quintessential Gerby photo is what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I think the best one was who was it? I think it was Steven Stamkos and Marty St. Louis from last year, but Stamkos had St. Louis like totally off the ground, and he was just kind of dangling there, and it looked like a dad and kid shot. That was hilarious. And then Tyler Myers, Nathan Gerby, we got one of those last year, and that was amazing. The big guy, little guy hug is the best. So really, any time Zdeno Chara is in a hug, that's great too, because he's just funny looking. And then two guys in midair. The leaping super hug is maybe my favorite. I mean, because still, we've done this a couple of years now, and I still think the best hockey hug I've ever seen is Phil Kessel and Dion Phaneuf midair, both of them kicking their legs back like mom just came home and bought them Polly Pockets. Like, the whole scene is remarkable.
What do you mean? What is a Polly Pocket? A Polly Pocket's a doll? Is that a doll?
No, it's like if I remember correctly, back from when I collected them all, they were like these little plastic compacts, and you open them up, and then there was like a little scene, and there's like
a little scene inside, right? Okay, I remember that now.
The tiny little doll, and then she had her like little scene in like her room or whatever.
Only thing I collected of that nature was when I was a young lad, I had my own Cabbage Patch doll named Jack Ziggy.
Well, see, I'm adopted, and when you get a Cabbage Patch doll, you get, like, an adoption certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, my mom got me one of those and was like, look, it's just like, when I got you. And then I was like, did I also come with this amazing baseball uniform?
Mine had a football uniform. I never really cared for him. So what I did was I buried him back in the Cabbage Patch, hoping that a new baby would spring up. Never did.
Oh, God.
Sorry. Never did. Harrison Mooney, Vicky Foley, by the way, Polly Pocket was the shit wish. I'm sorry. It probably was. It slips my mind as to now I'm going to be inundated. Here we go. Silky Mitts writes, Mighty Max, the boys' version of Polly Pocket. See, Mighty Max I get. If you had referenced Mighty Max, I would have gotten it. Polly Pocket, though, obviously something that Harrison Mooney might have been more into than someone like me.
Look, I don't want to say that Polly Pocket was greater than Mighty Max in every conceivable way, and Mighty Max was just the lame boy knockoff of a toy classic, but I'm going to say it. I'm going to say exactly what I just said. Mighty Max, lame boy knockoff, Polly Pocket, fabulous toy classic.
Amazing right scenes, too. Animal. Yeah, I'm seeing some of the Polly Pockets now. I did a little image search, and these are elaborate. It's almost like you having the lost city of Kandor in your pocket from the Superman comics. But thank you, Harrison Mooney, for joining us. I need to go and do some going postals before I have to give up this conference room for the third straight day. You're a gentleman and a scholar, and I love you.
Hey, thanks for having me. Love you, too.
Bye. The great Harrison Mooney. The great Harrison Mooney. It's time for a Wednesday favorite. You want to do a mailbag segment every week?
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyshynski. Not that deep.
We are nutting up for each other here.
Now's your chance to ask Merrick and Wyshynski anything, and we mean anything.
You got your thinking, Took?
Vegan cooking tips. Favorite Doctor Who characters. What's the best bar in Stouffville? Is there a bar in Stouffville? The meaning of life. Wait, let's not get carried away with that.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Random listener asks, is Greg eating trail mix on the show? The answer, yes. Eating trail mix as we speak, because what does Greg do on the show? He eats. Someone also asked me, with relation to that bar in Stouffville line we play in the opening, where my current drinking hole in my new town of Alexandria, Virginia is, I've been really digging going to Daniel O'Connell's pub down by the waterfront. But if anybody is like Virginia local, D.C., Alexandria, Fairfax County, wherever, and you want to hang and talk hockey and watch a game or something at Bugsy's one night, which is a hockey bar there, drop a line. Let me know. Maybe we'll watch some puck. Jason Chipman writes in. Wish, one movie you want remade and one you don't. It's a great question. The one I don't's easy. It's one of my favorite movies, but I also think it's a perfect movie for its time, for its era, for its acting. and it will never be replicated. All the President's Men should never be remade. It just should not. I mean, even if new shit comes to light and you wanted to do it in a different way, forget it. Never do better than Redford and Hoffman and that flick. It's just, it's one of the most perfect movies ever made, outside of the abrupt ending. Movie I'd love to see remade. I'll go a little bit obscure, but not too obscure if you're of my age, which is The Black Hole. Now, not the porno, of which there probably were about 700 named The Black Hole, come to think of it. But The Black Hole was, of course, a Disney attempt to replicate Star Wars, and a failed one at that. Awesome floating robots named Vincent and Bob. Awesome, spooky, evil robot named Maximilian, who had like propeller blades for hands. It's a great, great flick, and pretty good in the sense that it's got amazing special effects for the time it was made, but very, very dated, and the narrative I always felt could be really tightened up. But The Black Hole is like one of my favorite movies as a kid, and I would love to see that get remade in a proper way. Lexi writes in, hey guys, going postal question for today. Given Lamoriello's ... resourcefulness in the past, have you ever considered that Bettman simply didn't allow them to give up their 2012 draft pick since it was so low, as opposed to Lamoriello choosing to keep the pick? Oh man, I can't go down that road conspiratorially. I want to believe that, that's not the case. And everything I've been told and everything I know says that the Devils just decided to keep that pick, and it was a gigantic mistake. A gigantic mistake. I mean, let me move on because I'll just go down that road again. Jake writes in about that discussion we had yesterday about the Devils draft pick. If they have the number one pick and forfeit it after the lottery, the second place team's odds become the sum of the odds for the first and second teams, which isn't fair to the other teams. I think it's more likely that they reweight the odds based on the Devils pick not existing at all. It'll be a difference of 43.8% versus 25.1% going by last year's odds, and just a quick guess as to what they do in the second scenario. That makes sense. I mean, like, I didn't really think about the statistic reasons why you would take the Devils pick out of the equation, but you're right. It would obviously be more equitable to the other teams in the lottery if you did that. Patrick Clark, I hardly ever do Doctor Who questions on Going Postal because I like to be fair to Merrick. Merrick don't watch Doctor Who. Who is John Hurt's doctor in the upcoming 50th anniversary episode, and which person from the Who universe would best fit into the Hockeyverse? Obviously, he's a doctor who was lost in time, someone they've skipped over in the chronology of the Doctor, and someone who maybe they don't want to see return. I don't know the exact answer, but I'm so intrigued by it, and it kind of blew my mind to see it. Which person from the Who universe would best fit into the Hockeyverse? Dalek goalie, obviously. I mean, A, the proportions of the Dalek fit the crease pretty well. B, anyone who tries to crash the crease is exterminated. I mean, it's pretty obvious answer to there, personally. This is from Neil Schulman. Again, Devils question. As a fellow Devils fan, I'm not used to watching a terrible team. Bad team, no first rounder, and our only tradable players are the only ones who are actually playing well, Jagr and Ryder. Give me a reason to keep going. I'll give you two reasons, Metropolitan and Division. I'm sorry, but like we all ridiculed Claude Giroux yesterday for saying that he guaranteed the Flyers to make the playoffs. It's a terrible division. I mean, the Flyers, I think, are what, 7 out right now behind the Islanders? Maybe a little bit more, but in that neighborhood. And that's for the 3 seed. A terrible division. And maybe, just maybe, the Devils or Flyers can turn it around. I know what Merrick said yesterday. You'd have to hop over the Rangers, hop over the Capitals. Who knows? I mean, I'm just saying that the Metro is not as strong a division as we thought at the beginning of the season, and nothing's impossible. And yeah, maybe that is just me being an optimistic Devils fan, that things will always turn out and there's always a plan. But in this case, I don't know. That division, maybe it's because the Hurricanes and Capitals have poisoned what was the traditionally strong Atlantic Division with their Southeast nonsense, that all of a sudden becomes manageable. But I think nobody's out of it quite yet. Pierre Smith, love the show, and thanks for having so much fan interaction. Well, thank you. Which team do you think has the best goal horn celebration? For my money, I'm not even a Blue Jackets fan. The cannon after goals is pretty good, and the siren in Anaheim is lots of fun. I mean, the cannon, obviously, is one of the great gimmicks in the NHL as far as goal celebrations go. I base my goal celebration feelings on song played and the tone and pitch of the siren. I don't know if I have a favorite. I forget if it's Chicago or Buffalo has the goal horn where it just sounds like there is a train coming through the mezzanine. But the goal horn needs to sound like that. And then obviously the goal song needs to be something that you anticipate, like Chelsea Dagger, for example. So maybe I'm just saying Chicago is the answer, basically based on the criteria that I'm giving to you right now. So yeah. Mark Cole sent this in about superhero genre stuff, so I will answer it because I think I've skipped over it for a couple weeks. If you could pick the next superhero to get their own TV show or guest on an existing show like S.H.I.E.L.D. or Arrow, who would it be? Obvious answer is Black Panther, because as has been shown time and time again, female superheroes and African-American superheroes are not getting a break on the big screen. They're just not. So if you launch a Black Panther on an existing property or give him his own show and then bring him to the silver screen, I think that maybe that's the way to work it. But that's the only way you're going to see a character like that exist. And so that would be my my call on that one. Ben Glissman writes in. And this will be the last one because I have to get out of the conference room soon. Hey, Wish, speaking of sins, journalistic and otherwise, any plans to interview the Pope? Hey, Popes, you're so super famous. You must get mega laid. When's the last time you actually had to tug one out yourself? Just busting your balls. Hopefully you had a laugh and don't get sad. I'm not sad. That's why I told the Bobby Orr story at the beginning of the podcast. It's my mea culpa. It's my falling on my sword. It's admitting that I am a somewhat terrible journalist at times. And there it is. Merrick back tomorrow. Merrick back Friday. Game show Friday. All of these thoughts are combined, and all means good stuff for you. Thanks for hanging in there with me today. Thanks to Don Maloney for coming on. He's always a great guest. Harrison Mooney doing yeoman's work, bringing the joy of Polly Pocket to the podcast. Why don't they have Hockey Pocket, by the way? I'd buy that in a millisecond. A little scene, a little rink scene inside, with a little baby Johnny Taves and a little baby Patrick Kane.
Well, we had Peter Puck here. In Canada.
Did he open up and have stuff inside of him?
No, he was not. He was a cartoon character.
Well, I know that, but like, I'm saying as of or like the Polly Pocket, a little hockey scene inside. What do you think?
I think if you did that with Peter Puck, oh, that'd be huge.
So you take
all kinds of it.
You take a. So what we're essentially saying is this: you take the puck, you throw a logo on top of it. Puck opens up like a compact, and then inside is a little hockey scene.
Or, how better is this? A player's teeth.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this on the podcast before, but like occasionally on Puck Daddy, we run posts called Puck Treasures, in which we do like really amazing swag and stuff and memorabilia and stuff like that. And one of the things my white whale basically on eBay is finding a player's tooth. Like, that's always been the thing that I'm like, if I can find this one day.
That would be like pretty awesome.
Like, someone caught it in the audience somewhere, right? That kind of thing.
Or like a ref that fell into a gambling debt and was just selling anything he ever collected on the ice.
Yes. Steve Miller stole the tooth from the Chicago Blackhawks and skated off with it. And then claims not to know where it is. Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, maybe one day he'll put it on eBay when his drug addiction gets too much.
Hey, there's no... We don't know if he was... All we know is he's a forgetful guy. He stole the Stanley Cup winning puck and then, I don't know, freaked out and threw it away or, you know, traded it for blood diamonds or something. The world will never know. Anyway, thanks for joining me on the podcast today. Merrick back tomorrow and love you all. And that's it. Bye. We'll be right back.